Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Young, it's Here and Now. Two Democratic proposals to begin the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq this year have, as expected, gone down to defeat in the U.S. Senate. The first plan, which would require a troop pullout within the next year, lost by a vote of 86-13. The second, which set no timetable, was defeated by a 60-39 vote. Republicans labeled the proposal to pull out troops by the end of next year the cut-and-run option, and they derided the second proposal, the one to start phasing out troops sometime this year, as cut and jog. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid thanked Republicans for allowing a civil debate on the matter. Then he spoke of the heavy burden his home state of Nevada has seen, 39 deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan, and over 70% of the Nevada National Guard deployed.
They deserve an honest debate, not political slogans, and not a president and a Republican Congress content with no plan and no end in sight.
But Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist responded, saying withdrawal is not an option, surrender is not a solution.
We made an enormous investment in the success of this project. It would be foolish to squander that investment just as we are seeing success.
Well, joining us on the line now is Boston Globe Washington correspondent Rick Klein. And Rick, how does Senator John Kerry come out in all of this? He's the one who went out on a limb to set a definite timetable for withdrawal next year. That vote went down 86-13.
Yeah, I mean, interesting, though, his amendment was brought up last week as well, and that only got 6 votes. So the fact that he was able to get 13 votes, I think he's viewing as something of a victory.
Well, but, you know, the Republicans are as well. In many other ways, there's a sense that we've heard that Republicans feel they've end run the Democrats, that they've boxed them into a corner.
Yes, I mean, I think what's interesting is that we have both sides in this debate very eager to have the debate, and for very different reasons. The Democrats wanted to focus on some Bush administration missteps with the war by charting a different path forward, and the Republicans were saying, look, this is an opportunity to portray the Democrats as, in their words, supporting a cut-and-run policy. And so it's something where you really have both sides really talking past each other and very eager for the debate for different reasons.
And how much is Bill Frist's comment sticking, equating withdrawal with surrender?
Yeah, that's something that we heard from most of the Republicans. The one notable exception I'd add to that was Senator Chuck Hagel, who blasted his own fellow Republicans for the sloganeering, as he put it, with phrases like cut and run. It's clear that both sides were trying to make some political hay out of this issue, and I think it says something about the unpredictable politics of war that they were making it in much different directions.
Well, at one point this morning, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat, said 100% of the Democrats believe it's time for change. And he also said 100% of Republicans believe in staying the course. Your sense of that, I mean, how divisive within the parties is this?
Well, I think the fact that there had to be two competing Democratic proposals says something. The fact that Senator Kerry felt strongly about offering his, even with the slightly less strong alternative out there by Senators Reid and Levin, says that there are a lot of different opinions within the Democratic Party. On the Republican side, the only thing to note is that obviously there's strong support for the president. There was one Republican senator who voted for the troop withdrawal without a timeline, and that was Senator Lincoln Chafee from Rhode Island. He's actually the only Republican senator who voted against the war. And, of course, he's up for re-election this year in one of the most Democratic states in the nation.
Well, how much do you think this is all about the future? How much do you think this is about Senator John Kerry knowing that his bill was going to go down, you know, in defeat, knowing that he might be on record down the road if things in Iraq don't go well?
Well, I think for most of the senators today, there was no illusions that these proposals would actually pass and that it would actually dictate war policy. So a lot of it was positioning, and it was putting down some markers on this. Now, among the 2008 presidential contenders in the Senate, and there's 11 or 12 of them, about half of them Democrats, half of them Republicans, only Kerry and Senator Feingold, his co-sponsor, actually supported the quicker troop withdrawal. So it put the other presidential contenders, Senators Clinton, Biden, Dodd, Evan Bayh, in a bit of a tough spot, and they ended up all of them voting for the troop withdrawal without a timeline. They don't think a timeline is a good idea. So it does have the impact, and I think it's not unintentional on Senator Kerry and Senator Feingold's part of forcing the senators to make a statement on this issue.
Well, Democrats have circulated a memo from a Democratic pollster suggesting that Republicans will be the one to pay the price on this in November. But what is your sense of that in about the minute we have? Because we're also hearing analysts say in just about 2 weeks, the Republican Party has managed to completely reverse their fortunes with some of the news that we've seen.
Well, I don't know that I'd say a complete reversal at this point. Certainly news has gotten better for Republicans, but I think, you know, so much of this is just tied to the events on the ground in Iraq, and, you know, things can change, as we've seen many times before, very quickly in either direction. I think this Republicans do think, and this is something that helped them in 2002 and helped them in 2004, that returning to national security issues is something that benefits them as a party. Whether they can recreate that sort of magic in 2006 really remains to be seen. The Democrats will say over and over again, look, this is a different year. The climate is different. The public is at a different place with the war in Iraq and a range of other issues. So the old playbook won't work.
Rick Klein, Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe in Washington. Rick, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And now to Somalia, where Islamist militias have seized control of the capital city and the southern portion of this African country. Anti-American sentiment also seems to be growing in Somalia now that the Islamists have taken over for warlords who had been supported by the U.S. A recent article in The Economist magazine says American flags are being burned in even the quieter part of the capital city of Mogadishu. Well, all of this, of course, rekindles memories of 1993, when 18 American peacekeepers were killed in Mogadishu after the downing of two helicopters. Several hundred Somalis were also killed in the incident, which was documented in Mark Bowden's book, Black Hawk Down. Coming up, we're going to get Mark Bowden's perspective on what's going now in Somalia. But right now, we turn to Jonathan Lejard, Africa correspondent for The Economist. He joins us on a very difficult phone line from Nairobi. But Jonathan, we're pleased to have you. And tell us about these Islamic militias. Of course, when we think of Islamist militias, we think of Sharia law, the harsh fundamentalist law. How much of what we think of as Islamist fundamentalist thinking are they imposing?
Well, it's a very good question. Everyone has their own take on it. And I think the most important point is that people who really know Somalia and Mogadishu very well, they're the ones who are most cautious about predicting how the Islamists are going to turn out. But the general point of view is, among almost everyone except the Americans, the Islamists are basically good guys for the most part right now. If they are pushed into a corner by the United States and by Ethiopia, could turn radical. But there's not much indication at the moment to suggest that they're anything other than strict and rather stern Islamic jurists. And I think it's very important for people to distinguish between the Al-Qaeda threat and people who are pushing law and order in a city which has not seen any law and order of any kind since 1991-92.
Well, let's talk about that. The country had been run by warlords. The U.S. threw its weight behind the warlords who promised to search for and fight Al-Qaeda. How were the warlords that these militias have just taken over from, how were they viewed?
Well, if you talk to any average person in Mogadishu, a mother who's trying to put a kid into school or a guy who's trying to run a market store, they hated the warlords. These guys were tyrants, they were thugs, they murdered people indiscriminately, and they lied constantly to American intelligence in order to protect their commercial power. And you know, an indication and a proof of this is the fact that they divided up Mogadishu into fiefdoms, and they ran checkpoints between these fiefdoms. So if you wanted to visit your brother on the other side of town, you might end up paying $8-$10 just to get through the checkpoint. And what you see with the Islamists is a kind of people power of ordinary people in Mogadishu saying, enough, no more men with guns, we're going to run our own government, and we're going to do a better job. Now, obviously, within the Islamist militias, there are some people who are openly sympathetic to Al-Qaeda and to jihadist terrorism. But they're trying to sound very moderate at the moment.
But running parallel to that, some concerns. You write about a recent court ruling under Sharia law which allowed a young boy to stab his father's murderer to death in front of a cheering crowd. We're talking about Somalia with Jonathan Lejard, Africa correspondent for The Economist. He's on with a very sketchy phone line from Nairobi. And Jonathan, even though the current government is meeting today with the Islamists, there is concern that the conflict in Somalia is going to draw in troops from other countries, such as Ethiopia, and also concern, you tell us, about a famine?
The famine south of Mogadishu, it's really catastrophic, and if anything, it's more important than what is actually happening in the city of Mogadishu at the moment. Most people in the World Food Program who are following it say that it's the worst famine in the world anywhere on the planet right now. And we're looking at 5,000 to 10,000 people, mostly children, dying of hunger there every month. So that's another reason why we need to work with the Islamists to get them on board. I think most people who follow Somalia view this as the best opportunity for peace in the country since the Black Hawk Down and period in 1992-93.
That's Jonathan Lejard. He's Africa correspondent for The Economist, and he was speaking to us from Nairobi. Well, we turn now to Mark Bowden, author of the book Black Hawk Down, which details that horrible incident in October of 1993 in Somalia when 18 U.S. soldiers were killed along with hundreds of Somalis after two U.S. helicopters went down. Those American soldiers were sent in to capture a violent warlord. And Mark, before we take a quick break, your thoughts on what Jonathan just said, that the fact that Islamist militias have taken over from those warlords, if it works, is perhaps the best thing that could happen to Mogadishu.
I agree with Jonathan. You have to consider first things first. And you know, when I left Mogadishu in 1997, I left feeling very sorry for the majority of Somalis, and particularly the well-educated ones, who were trapped in this hopeless anarchical situation where the warlords had divvied up the city into fiefs and were battling with each other every day, and it just seemed to be impossible. So to me, any group that can restore some kind of order to that country or into that city deserves to be given a chance.
We are talking about Somalia with Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down. When we come back, we'll get Mark's take on concerns that, like the Taliban in Afghanistan, the Islamists in Somalia might become a haven for Al-Qaeda. Also, later in the program, we're going to speak to the outgoing leader of the Episcopal Church in the United States. We'll ask, why did the church reverse its position yesterday on electing gay bishops? Much more coming up here and now. Here and now, and we're back with Black Hawk Down author Mark Bowden talking about the current situation in Somalia where Islamist militias have taken control from the warlords in the capital city of Mogadishu. And Mark, as you well know, the warlords promised the U.S. that they would go after Al-Qaeda. So the U.S. government backs the warlords and not the Islamist militias, the U.S. concern being that those militias will become like the Islamists in Afghanistan, for instance, and Somalia will become a haven for Al-Qaeda.
Well, I think we can deal with that if it becomes a problem, but, you know, I think the world presents you always with difficult choices, and a lot of times choices between things that you'd rather not be choosing between. But the truth is that the warlords in Somalia have ravaged that country for the last 15 years and have prevented the formation of any kind of civil society, and that's what most of the people there, and I think everywhere, crave. And when I was in Somalia in 1997, the only people I saw who were public-spirited and who were working in the interests of the community were the Islamists. And yes, that's a cause for concern But where there's a vacuum, somebody moves into it. And in this case, I think we need to give these people a chance to define themselves. And if they define themselves as a problem for the United States and the rest of the world, well, then we'll have to deal with that. But I think first things first.
What do you think the U.S. should be doing in Somalia?
Well, I would like to see us quietly supporting any movement toward a restoration of civil society. But I say that recognizing that there's very little stomach in this country for any kind of intervention or aid in Somalia. And I told that actually to my Somali friends when I was there. I think that, frankly, Somalia missed a very good chance back in 1993 when the UN was there, and they may never get it again.
Because of the Black Hawk Down incident.
Not just that, but that was the biggest episode, yes. And, you know, essentially the inability of the various factions, and most of them were warlords, to form a coalition government when they had a lot of help and there was tremendous international goodwill and a great deal of money prepared to be invested in that country if they could get their act together, and they couldn't. And so I think they missed a wonderful opportunity, and it's sad. But I think like people who are struggling anywhere, I would like to see the United States helping them.
Do you think that over time, and particularly since 9/11, the Islamists in Somalia have become radicalized?
I'm sure that some of them have, and I encountered some myself when I was in Mogadishu. But Somalia is a Muslim country. Most of the Muslims I met there were not extremists. That was just their religion. And some of them were putting their religion into practice by doing good works in the community. They were the only ones, frankly, who I saw making that kind of an effort. So it's quite possible that the people who have banded together to finally deal a blow to these warlords are decent, moderate people who just want some order in their lives.
We're talking to Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down, about the current situation in Somalia. But while we have you, Mark, I was just wondering, all the news that's coming out of Iraq and what you might be thinking about that, specifically the story of two American soldiers who'd been captured, tortured, perhaps dragged behind a pickup truck and beheaded. Did you think of Mogadishu?
Oh, of course. I mean, and it's just savage. War is savage. And, young men and women are being killed every day in Iraq. This is a particularly horrifying death. But death is death. And, I think that the people who kidnapped these two soldiers were obviously acting out some kind of savage rage and in an effort to send a message, which is exactly what the Somalis were doing in Mogadishu. And it is just a fact that when you send people off to war, that they are going to encounter this kind of savagery, and it's one of the strong reasons why you ought to be very loath to do it in the first place.
It's just also a reminder that, here we are, however many years later, and Somalia is still, maybe righting itself. Some people are hoping that that's the result of the militias taking over from the warlords. But it's been a mess ever since.
It has. And as I said, I think that they missed an opportunity. And I worry about Iraq in the same way. I think Iraq has a remarkable opportunity to, if the Iraqi people themselves can set aside these religious and ethnic differences and pull together. I mean, they have a rare opportunity to establish a stable civil society, but that's a tall order, and we may be, as Americans, overly optimistic about the ability of other people to do what we have been struggling to do in this country for 200 years.
Well, it strikes me that in both places, in both Iraq and Somalia, it may not be the government the U.S. wishes, but it may be the best government for the country.
Precisely. I think that our form of government grew organically out of our traditions, and you can't, it seems to me, with ease go to a foreign culture with a completely different history, with completely different values, and expect that they are going to take readily to something that doesn't come naturally to them. We can hope, and we can provide incentives, and we can provide advice and guidance and opportunity, but ultimately, I think we have to be realistic that people around the world are different. They're not all like us, and they don't want to be like us.
Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down, talking to us about Somalia. But by the way, his latest book is about the Iranian hostage crisis. It's called Guests of the Ayatollah. Mark, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin. My pleasure.
And stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now.
The Triennial General Convention of the Episcopal Church of America, which met this week in Columbus, Ohio, once again made headlines, electing the first woman head of the Episcopal Church in America, and yesterday reversing church position on the election of gay clergy. The church, which 3 years ago elected its first gay bishop, yesterday passed a resolution, although not a moratorium, on electing gay men and women. The resolution asks dioceses not to give consent to candidates whose manner of life presents a challenge to the wider church. As the Episcopal Church stands at this crossroads, we wanted to talk to Bishop Frank Griswold, who's been the church's presiding bishop for the last 9 years. Bishop Griswold, welcome.
Thank you.
And I want to go first to yesterday's news. Do you feel this is a step back? Because, after all, it was under your leadership just 3 years ago that the church elected Gene Robinson from New Hampshire to be the first openly gay bishop.
No, I think the church's commitment to the full inclusion of gay and lesbian people is very, very clear. The larger question is the relation of the Episcopal Church to the larger Anglican Communion, where the ordination of the Bishop of New Hampshire has caused a great deal of concern. And I think the resolution yesterday is a way of the church saying we want to be in deeper conversation with brothers and sisters in other parts of the Anglican world, but we realize that in order to enter into that conversation, we must restrain ourselves and not allow the presenting issue to be seen as an aggressive agenda.
There was a report which was issued by the church which recommended that the church apologize for electing Gene Robinson and consider a moratorium on the election of gay men and women to the clergy. Earlier this week, there was an apology from the church apologizing for hurt feelings, but not exactly apologizing for electing a gay bishop. There was a resolution yesterday, but not a moratorium. So, has it been hard to sort of please both sides?
I think that what we've seen at this convention is the emergence of what I would call the diverse center. Men and women who have divergent points of view but share a common sense of being church together, and therefore that large center is looking for ways of fostering relationships with other parts of the communion. Mm-hmm. And I think that the consensus that you described is an effort to do precisely that. Of course, it doesn't completely satisfy people on the right or the left, but I would say the center was solidly together. And the apology you're describing, I think we are very aware of the negative effects in other parts of the world our actions have had, and we deeply regret ways in which brother and sister Anglicans have been negatively affected by our actions, but I think the majority here also feels that they cannot apologize for what they felt was a right action, albeit problematic.
Which was the election of Gene Robinson. You mentioned other parts of the world. In some parts of the world, homosexuality is illegal. How do you address that, that there are Episcopalians living in places in other countries where it is illegal to be a homosexual?
Well, one of the things I've tried to emphasize over the last 9 years is deep conversation, openness to those who have very different perspectives and very different points of view. And out of that undefended stance toward the other can grow a conversion.
It's interesting when you use the word conversation and conversion so close together.
Well, they both come from the same Latin root, which is an interesting fact.
So you're hoping that one leads to the other. But
one leads to the other, and then conversion, which has to do not with a change of perspective, let's say, but a change of heart.
Well, that's your hope. But what is your concern about those on the right in the church who did not want to see a resolution about gay bishops? They wanted to see a moratorium, a flat-out moratorium, who wanted to have an apology for the election of a gay bishop 3 years ago, and who have been talking about schism.
I think that you mentioned the right. I think the left can also be put in a somewhat similar camp. They also were very opposed to the consensus that emerged. And I found it interesting that people on the right and the left, in essence, voted together against a resolution for quite different reasons.
This is just one of the many issues that you've confronted in the past 9 years. When you started the job, how did you hope you'd leave the church?
Well, I mentioned conversation, conversion, communion. I started with that as the message because certainly 9 years ago there was a great deal of tension. And I must say, over the last 9 years, I've been quite frankly appalled by, what would I say, the polarizing energies that have taken over not only the church but also political discourse. And my own sense is that truth is always larger than any one perspective. I need your sense of truth to challenge mine, to stretch mine, and I think that one of the great gifts of the church is that people together seek the deeper truth of God, and that is not an easy thing to do, but that's what I've been about over the last 9 years, and even with the controversies that have come along the way, I feel that really has been in large measure what has happened.
That's such an interesting thing to hear the head of a church say, because in effect you're saying that God's truth may be larger even than the church.
Absolutely. I mean, after all, in one of the Gospels, Jesus says, "I have many more things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now. However, when the Spirit of truth comes, the Spirit will draw from what is mine and reveal it to you," which suggests to me truth is unfolding. God's truth is always unfolding. And I think we can accept this with respect to new knowledge about the world around us, new discoveries in medicine, and yet in certain areas, sexuality being one, we say we have all the truth we need and are threatened if there is a new sense of the mystery of sexuality, or we contemplate other than classical expressions of that sexuality.
You're saying that Jesus might have had more to say about...
I think Jesus has much more to say, and Jesus continues to speak through history, through human experience and discovery, and I don't think we're ever going to know all the depth of the truth which is in Jesus.
Bishop Frank Griswold, presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church since 1997. His tenure comes to a close in November. And one last question, Bishop Griswold. You're being replaced by a woman. As you know, there are three dioceses in the U.S. that don't even have women priests. Now they'll have a woman as the head of their church. How do you see that road ahead?
Well, I think that the overwhelming support that Catherine Jefferts Schori has received in the course of this convention and the grace with which she has spoken will serve her well in the days ahead, and I hope that some of those who are at this point unsettled by her election will in time see her as the leader she is.
Bishop Griswold, you know the saying, may you live in interesting times.
These have been interesting times.
Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you.
And as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. You're listening to Here and Now.
Hey, boy, this is back. Ghana, oh, say. Uma Ghana, oh, say. Oh, Sony Powers.
Kuzia, Ghana scored, huh?
Ghana has scored the same goal. That's all that matters about it.
That was how my late mom's beloved former home health aide, Akuzia, answered the phone to anyone who called this morning, but in particular me. Akuzia is from Ghana, and if you haven't heard by now, her team will be advancing to the second round of the World Cup. The U.S. will not. They lost to Ghana 2-1 in Nuremberg this morning. Reactions from a bar near us in Alston, Massachusetts, were a little more restrained.
In soccer, you have to get the luck break. You have to get the big break. We didn't get the big save from Keller. We didn't get the finish from the guys when they had the chances up front, and I didn't think Donovan played well at all.
I was disappointed with the calls of the refs.
Well, I was torn because I live in the U.S., but Ghana is an African team, so I was torn in between, but the Ghanaians played better, so they deserved it.
I live in U.S., and I cheer for U.S., but I'd rather see Ghanaian win because it seems like they're representing the African, you know, much better than any other African club side so far.
Well, then you're a happy guy because they did win. Joining us in the studio is only a game host and avid soccer fan, Bill Littlefield. And Bill, I have to say, walking around here today, every television set here in this radio station was tuned to this game. People were really watching this.
Absolutely. And it's been true of the World Cup so far. Lots and lots of folks in the U.S. getting caught up in this event.
I actually heard that the television viewing has spiked 133%.
Yeah.
I heard that.
Yeah. Well, it's partly, of course, because you don't have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to see the game. And Germany's a great place to have the World Cup. As far as U.S. fans are concerned, we can watch games during the daytime.
Well, and as far as my friend Akuzia is concerned, it's because Ghana is
absolutely
such a magnificent
sports is wonderful. Everybody's heartbreak is somebody else's triumphant victory, and that's as it should be.
Well, no one picked Ghana to advance.
No.
Then they stunned the Czech Republic 2-0, and now going to the second round. Your thoughts on the game?
Well, my thoughts on the game just completed are simply that the better team won. Ghana knew what they had to do, and they did it. And the U.S. also knew what they had to do, and they simply didn't put the ball on the goal often enough. They had a couple of bad breaks, one shot that hit the post and a penalty call that a lot of people will argue with. But really, when all is said and done, they just didn't play well enough to win.
Right. But there, I mean, from what I could hear, as I was working very hard, there would be these yells. So there seemed to be, you know, outside of the scoring, there seemed to be some moments.
There are always are moments, and there were a couple of good rushes and a couple of good chances, but soccer, the proportion of scores that you get compared to the proportion of time that you almost score is fairly low, and that's just the way the game works.
We've talked about this. There should be some sort of second tier, like another big, wider net so that they can get...
Just assume leave the net. I think the action in this World Cup has been spectacular. We've seen some great play, and of course, with Ghana advancing, as you suggest, Robin, a wonderful surprise.
Right.
And, you know, the World Cup is built for this sort of
right.
thing.
Well, later today, Croatia plays Australia. Japan takes on Brazil, everyone's favorite Goliath. The Japanese coach quoted as saying earlier this week that he doesn't think Brazil, as an opponent, is particularly frightening. Is he faking, or does
yes,
he?
Yes, whatever substance he's been indulging in is most decidedly illegal, and we probably should talk no more about it. He is a former Brazilian player, a wonderful player on the Brazilian side some years back, and it's the kind of thing that coaches, of course, have to say. And I'm sure that when Ghana gets ready to play Brazil in the second round, you can count on the coach from Ghana to say pretty much the same thing. We're not afraid of Brazil.
Only a game host, Bill Littlefield, he'll be covering the World Cup, of course, and all sorts of other news from the world of sports this week and on his show. Real quick, what other matches should we look for?
I think once the second round begins, Portugal and the Netherlands should be a wonderful match. Both teams have looked very strong in the early going. I'm also interested in England against Ecuador, mostly because England lost Michael Owen, and there is a chance that they will be using a 17-year-old up front who has no international experience at all.
Well, and of course, according to Akuzia, Ghana will be going all the way. Hear their national anthem. We might be hearing it. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
T
Here and Now. The island of Sicily is rich in natural resources, history, and myth. It's also one of the poorest areas of Europe, due in part to the Italian mafia, which has helped strangle development. But with the capture in March of mafia boss of bosses Bernardo Provenzano, Sicily's economy may be ready to rev up. Part of that revival, a proposed bridge across the Straits of Messina, the choppy ribbon of sea that divides the island from the mainland. The bridge would provide a stable automobile and high-speed rail link, but the bridge project lost one of its champions with the recent ouster of longtime Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. Now, enthusiasm for that project is waning. Ken Schulman spent a week on both sides of the straits and has this story.
This is Scilla, a small seaside village on the Calabrian side of the Straits of Messina. It's not far from where the north tower of the proposed Straits of Messina bridge would stand. Poets Homer and Ovid, and even pop star Sting, have sung about Scilla, a mythical six-headed sea monster who lived here, and about the deadly whirlpools of Charybdis on the Sicilian side of the straits. The whirlpools of Charybdis, still visible today, are generated by violent tides that change every 6 hours. Still, says art historian Elena De Luca, this knowledge merely adds to the charm of the straits, a charm she thinks will be shattered if the bridge across the straits is built.
These natural sites aren't just natural sites. They're also cultural sites. They're steeped in history, in centuries of civilization. Everybody here knows who the Greeks were, who the Phoenicians were, who the Normans were. We have them in our DNA, in everything around us. The bridge would violate this continuity, along with the lives of the people who live here.
The past is a boon for people living on the straits, yet it's also a burden, especially the recent past. Centuries of foreign occupation, followed by decades of neglect by the Italian government, have left these regions laggards. Unemployment is far above mainland levels. Services are substandard. Corruption and organized crime are rampant and deeply rooted. Domenico Marino is a professor of economics at the University of Reggio Calabria.
Sicily and Calabria are an unusual case. Research shows that we spend at the same levels that people in more industrialized regions spend. This means that up to half of the actual economy is illegal.
The two-tier economy produces a system riddled with greed, graft, and waste. The local landscape is littered with skeletons of half-finished hotels, highway ramps stopped in midair, projects abandoned when funds from Rome ran out, or were siphoned dry by local politicians and mafia leaders. Marino fears that much of the $6 billion needed to build the bridge will end up in the hands of the mafia and of the 'Ndrangheta, the mafia's Calabrian counterpart. He fears that work on the project will stall or even stop. It's happened before, he says.
The upgrade of the Salerno-Calabria Highway, 800 kilometers of road that were supposed to be finished in 3 years, isn't even halfway done after 10. Contractors, controlled by organized crime, got in through rigged bids and intimidation. Aside from driving costs up, there is no guarantee that this sort of contractor even has the capacity to do the work. These are the people who will be doing the work on the bridge?
While the physical distance across the straits is largely unchanged since the last ice age, the economic gap between the south and the rest of Italy continues to widen. Nino Calarco is director of La Gazzetta del Sud, one of southern Italy's most popular daily newspapers. From 1990 to 2001, he served as president of the company that manages the finances of the bridge project. He says the bridge will help revive the region.
Recently, there's been a boom in trade between Europe and Asia. Ships are returning to the Mediterranean through the Suez Canal. We have to transform Sicily into a port that can intercept this traffic, unload the ships, and transport the containers by rail to the mainland. This is our future.
While some locals along the straits believe the bridge will create jobs and perhaps attract tourists, most are either indifferent to the project or strongly opposed. Their opinion, however, has little weight. According to Italian law, local communities cannot vote to stop projects that Rome designates as strategically important. The Straits of Messina has carried this designation since 1971. Besides, says Calatco, change always generates resistance.
There has never been a major human undertaking that wasn't met with strong opposition. There are always critics and skeptics. To these, I respond by saying that if Pharaoh had had to conduct a public opinion survey to build the pyramids, we wouldn't have the pyramids today.
Every day, state and private ferries shuttle 34 trains, 3,300 trucks, 6,300 cars, and over 12,000 pedestrian commuters across the Straits of Messina. The system works well for locals, but the bridge isn't intended for their use or benefit. Renato Accorenti is a physical education teacher in the city of Messina. He thinks the idea that the bridge will somehow resuscitate Sicily's economy is absurd.
Take a look at Calabria. It's connected to the continent, and their economy is more depressed than ours. And take a look at Japan, a bunch of islands. How did they manage to become such an industrial powerhouse without a bridge to connect them to the mainland? It doesn't depend on a bridge. It depends on building a healthy economy.
For Accorenti, the money needed to build the bridge would be better spent on upgrading the region's roads, railways, and hotels. Instead of a transshipment center, he'd like to transform Sicily into a center for sustainable agriculture and intelligent ecotourism.
We have more than 600 miles of beaches. We have one of the most pleasant climates in the world. We have half the archaeological sites of Italy, which has half of the sites in the world. We have Etna, a volcano where you can look down at the sea while you ski on snow. Who else has these things? How is it possible that we have unemployment in the midst of all this splendor?
At just over 2 miles, the bridge across the Straits of Messina would be the longest single-span suspension bridge ever attempted. It's a challenge for engineers, along with the gusty winds and frequent earthquakes that rock the straits. The project will also inflict significant damage on the ecosystem, one of the rarest and most vital in the Mediterranean. Still, it is tempting to envision the bridge, glistening above the peaks of its majestic ancient landscape. What is less alluring is imagining all that this vision might cost.
And with E. Pagliacci's Cavalleria Rusticana transporting us, that's Ken Schulman in Messina, Italy. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Hitesh Hati, Molly Hamill, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Schuchertz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Jamie Ulrich, Lauren Morand, Jessica Wall. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.